Call this committee to order. Welcome, members. I see we do have a quorum now, so I would like to move the minutes, members. The minutes of February 26th. Would you like to move those, Representative Falk?
Yes, he's
not a
yes.
Representative Falk, I'm calling on you to move the minutes.
Madam Chair, I move approval of the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Falk. And any discussion to those minutes, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay? All right, the minutes have been approved. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. I would move House File 194 be recommended pass and refer to the General Register.
Representative Atkins moves House File 194 to be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Atkins, do you have testifiers today?
I do, Madam Chair, and before that, I just wanted to alert some folks. I had thoughts of possibly doing an amendment in this committee. I believe an amendment that will go on in the Senate. By virtue of the fact we don't have a 24-hour rule, as members know in this committee, we don't have rules at all. But I do feel a sense of respect for those that would be impacted, and I don't think they had very much time to see that amendment, so I am not offering that amendment today. I do want to make a record, though, for the for proponents and opponents that that very well may go on in the Senate. It's possible it could be offered in the House floor. There's all sorts of possibilities. I just didn't want folks to think it was completely going away, but I didn't think it was fair to members to have it go on without having an opportunity for everybody to fully appreciate what was involved with it. And I do think it's likely that it's probably going to go on in the Senate. With that, Madam Chair, I'll do a very brief description of the bill, because when you do have testifiers, I've learned as an author that you keep your mouth shut mostly. We've got in Minnesota what I would describe as an epidemic of scams aimed primarily at Minnesota seniors. They involve the one common denominator in all of the various scams, whether they are so-called grandparent scams, where you've got kids calling up, or scammers who sound like children who call elderly Minnesotans and pose as their grandchildren. They say that they're injured, they're in a hospital in New York. That's what happened to my parents. For the 75 members at Gramercy Park Cooperative, which is a senior facility in Inver Grove, I visited with them, asked them if anybody had described what happened to my son. I said, have any of you gotten that sort of call? Every single hand went up. And then afterwards, a half dozen came up to me and said that they had actually wired money. And we're out that money. The one common denominator in these sorts of scams is the fact that the money is wired somewhere. The scammers like that because they can pick it up at some place other than where it's sent. So, for example, you think in my parents' case, they never sent any money because they actually fortunately called me to find out if my son was okay. But he was injured in a hospital in New York and needed some money wired to him there. The reason the scammers like that is because the money doesn't have to be picked up in New York. It could be picked up several miles away or in a different state altogether. What I would do at this point, I think, is turn it over. We've got Special Agent Arlt, who's retired from public safety, who can give some more details, as well as some folks who've been directly impacted by it. But it's a significant problem, particularly in Minnesota, with 100,000 claims and $4 or $5 million a year in losses. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Arlt, Special Agent Arlt, who I believe is in the room, but I don't see him approaching. There he is.
Okay, good.
And he can give you some background, and then I'd like to have you hear directly from some people who've been impacted by it.
Thank you, Representative Atkinson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and state your name and proceed with your testimony, please.
Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Jim Arlt. As Representative Atkins says, I am retired. But I did have the privilege to serve the citizens of Minnesota for over 33 years. The last 21 of those years of my career, I worked for the Department of Public Safety in the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. While working at the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, we saw an ever-increasing rate of complaints from Minnesota citizens about foreign lottery scams. Typically, these citizens were elderly, We started a program in the fall of 2007 that we called MinScams. From that start date until I retired basically a year ago, we had received over 100,000 complaints of scams, of frauds, and attempted frauds. And the reported dollar losses for the last 2 years of that time period were running between $4 to $5 million. Now, this particular crime is reported at a severely underrated rate. What we've been told is that it typically about 5% of the victims will report. I believe we were doing a little bit better than that just from our efforts, but again, nowhere near had predominant as far as what we believe was occurring. The MinScams effort was mainly focused on receiving and investigating foreign lottery fraud complaints and was conducted with limited resources. It wasn't uncommon for the elderly victims of the foreign lottery scams to have sent all the money available to them before a complaint was received by our division. Some of these victims had been threatened or had the lives of their grandchildren threatened if they wanted to quit sending money. Sometimes the elderly victim would be tested later and determined to be a vulnerable adult as their mental cognitive abilities had declined. Families were extremely frustrated as they tried to keep their loved ones from sending money and desperate also to find a law enforcement entity that would do more than just take the complaint and file it. Most of these senior citizens did not even know where the money had actually been received, even though they had paid a company to send the money and they had designated a location. The foreign lottery type of fraud is not going away, and if anything, it appears to be growing exponentially. According to a recent report of the United States Federal Trade Commission, just the Jamaican version alone was reported as could be bilking older Americans out of as much as $1 billion a year. Jamaica is only one of a number of foreign lottery fraud receiving locations. The three largest frauds that target senior citizens, from my viewpoint, was the foreign lottery scams, the grandparent emergency scams, and romance or relationship type of scams. If an intended victim of a grandparent emergency scam would be advised that the money that they had sent to North Bay, Ontario, was being attempted to be picked up in Montreal or Vancouver, that victim would be given a chance to realize that it didn't make any sense. Why? Because the money was going to be used for little Johnny's bail to get out of jail in North Bay, Ontario. Just by now receiving the knowledge of the attempted receiving location where the crooks were going to pick it up, it could actually stop this crime from occurring. I had the pleasure of training and working with Canadian law enforcement assigned to investigate these crimes. I also traveled to Jamaica and worked with the Jamaican Constabulary Force there, where they conducted search warrants and arrested suspects involved in this crime. I saw the sucker or intended victim list that they were using and saw all the names listed with the Minnesota address. I was told by these law enforcement entities that their investigations had shown that organized crime or criminal groups were involved in perpetrating these crimes. In Canada, it was reported that traditional organized crime groups, those that we traditionally believe out of New York and in that area, were involved, along with Eastern European organized criminal groups and West African organized criminal groups. In Jamaica, it was their gangs. The money transmittal companies used to facilitate a large percentage of these monies are acutely aware of these crimes occurring and the use of their services to facilitate the transference of the proceeds. Both of the major companies have been investigated by the National Attorney General's Association. MoneyGram has also been investigated by the Federal Trade Commission and most recently by the U.S. Attorney's Office. There is extensive public information available on the Internet as to the results of those investigations. At international law enforcement conferences, representatives of MoneyGram and Western Union have been asked about restricting the receiving of the monies to the location that the sender has designated. This change in procedure was requested for three reasons. First, so that the victim will have the information of where their money went when they report the crime to law enforcement people. Second, so law enforcement could send money on behalf of victims and have other law enforcement investigate the criminals involved by identifying them when they receive the monies. And last, so that the transactions where the monies are being received in a different location than the victim designated, this restriction may give the victim enough information to choose not to proceed with the transaction. Both companies' representatives at these conferences stated that this would be a change in their business plan and could not be done independently, as it would give their competitors a business advantage. I strongly recommend the passage of the common sense proposal contained in this bill in an attempt to protect Minnesota citizens that are vulnerable to these crimes. And that is my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to take it.
Well, Representative Atkins, I thought that we could hear all of the testifiers, and then, members, we could ask our questions after that. You're going to be sticking around, sir?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, then, I'd like to call the next testifier down. Is it Peggy Heistad Hari? Peggy? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and give your testimony.
Madam Chair and representatives, my name is Peggy Heistad Hari, and I'm an ARP member from Duluth. I am here to tell my family's story about wire transfer fraud, a story that happens all too often across the state of Minnesota. On behalf of ARP, I'd first like to thank Representative Joe Atkins for listening to these stories and acting. You are providing the leadership we need to help stop wire transfer fraud, a devastating crime that caught my mother. Over a period of 10 days in June 2010, my mother, who lives only on a very small pension and Social Security, was coerced into sending $47,000, which included $10,000 in cash, to a Jamaican scam. How did this happen? A phone call from Jamaica advised her that she had won $2.5 million in a Mercedes-Benz. Several calls later, she was convinced to send money to ship the car. During the period of the next 10 days, the calls kept coming, becoming more demanding and more personalized. They somehow knew that church was important to her, and the caller claimed to be a minister. The caller gained her trust and coached her exactly where to obtain cash advances on her credit cards, which were zero balance, and they walked her through exactly how to wire money. Now, she had never wired money in her life, and told her to go to Kmart and or Super One in West Duluth near her home. It was incredibly easy. Not once was she stopped along the way. At one point, she actually withdrew $10,000 in cash, put it in an envelope, and traveled across town to send it. Before we knew it, she had maxed out 2 zero balance credit cards and went into severe credit card debt. What we know now is that this scam stemmed from a hotbed of illegal criminal activity that targets older Minnesotans. These fraudsters either seduce vulnerable citizens to send money for promised goods or winnings that do not exist, or they convince them that their grandchildren or loved ones are in danger and need them to wire money. Most people don't report this crime. In fact, experts say that only 5% of the crimes are reported. It's too embarrassing, and law enforcement can do little to stop it. Minnesota needs to pass this bill to better protect its most vulnerable citizens, our elders. For our family, it was a year of heartbreak. As we tried to help my mother. My mother, at age 83, had to file bankruptcy, as her interest alone on her credit card debt was more than her income. We realized that there was very little to do. We contacted the FBI, the Secret Service, Homeland Security, Duluth Police, Postmaster General, Attorney General, and the Minnesota Public Safety. The only help we received was from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Both my mother and I attended an ARP Fraud Fighters Forum in November 2010 in Duluth, where we heard from ARP, the Attorney General, and investigator Jim Arlt talk about fraud. When he spoke about victims exactly like my mom, we realized we were not alone. Too many seniors across our state have lost their life savings, They feel so much shame, and they isolate themselves and suffer alone. Our seniors deserve more protection from fraud. Our taxpayers deserve it too, because millions of hard-earned dollars are wired down the drain every year. We all need to be leaders by passing this legislation, and in doing so, provide a strong example of taxpayers protecting our vulnerable citizens. Our elders have worked hard, paid taxes, and followed the laws. Now they need protection against this illegal activity. It has been almost 3 years since this happened to my mom. When I asked her what it felt like to hold $10,000 in cash as she put it in an envelope to mail it, she said, "I don't remember. They had my mind. I didn't know what I was doing." There has not been a day in her life since those 10 days in June of 2010 that has been normal for her. The outcome of this has been a nightmare. Not only has she lost her financial independence, her health has deteriorated. She has isolated herself, and she feels ashamed. These scammers not only took money from my mother, but her health and spirit as well. On behalf of my mother and all the seniors across the state who have fallen victim to this crime, I would like to urge you to support the passage of this bill to protect seniors from wire transfer fraud. We have a duty to create a safety net to question, delay, and stop our most vulnerable citizens from wiring away their life savings. I never thought something like this would happen to my mother. Now I know it can happen to anyone, anyone's mother, neighbor, or friend. We all need to pay more attention to our elders and to pass strong laws that will help them avoid frauds. Minnesota seniors are worth protecting. They are our mothers, our fathers, our grandmothers, and our grandfathers. They protected us when we were young, and now we need to protect them. Please support this legislation. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your courage and your mother's courage to come forward. Appreciate it. The next testifier is Jody Buell. Jody?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Representatives. My name is Jody Buell. I'm a lifetime resident in Minnesota. I live in Burnsville with my two teenage kids and my husband of 4 years. I am 56 years old. I don't look like I have a diminished capacity. I don't look like a vulnerable adult. Yet 5 years ago, I fell victim to an online predator, a scammer, a criminal, who bilked me out of about $12,000. Now, like most victims of this kind of crime, I was completely unaware that this type of criminal activity even existed. I knew not to send anything to somebody I didn't know. But by the time the first request came, I would have sworn on a Bible that I knew him well. I knew not to respond to those get-rich-quick schemes. But what I didn't know was that polished, professional, trained crime rings are allowed to reach me with ease through dating sites, that they would pretend to be someone they weren't, and that they would patiently take months to spin a completely believable life and groom me in order to earn my trust long before any requests would come. Now, once I learned the truth of my situation, I was also shocked to find that there were no law enforcement agencies to turn to. Every single one I contacted, including our own attorney general, told me it wasn't something that they dealt with. There was no agency, no police department, no law enforcement professional that I could turn to report to this crime. So instead, I turned to the one place that I found that could understand what I was going through, and I became a moderator on a highly reputable website by the name of romancescams.org. I spent hundreds of hours reading and learning and turning the tables as best that I could by helping countless others who continue to pour into our site every single day. I began to speak publicly to anyone who would listen. I face ridicule and prejudice because I know that every single time I speak up, somebody comes to me and whispers, "It happened to me too." Most of our members are older, Since opening our doors, almost 60,000 people have joined our site. We currently have 19,638 active members. A classic victim is over 50, male or female, divorced or widowed, and open to finding that special someone to live the rest of their lives with. I personally have seen members on our site from Lakeville, Shakopee, Savage, Aiken, Duluth, Fergus Falls, Bloomington, Brainerd, St. Cloud, Rochester, Edina, and the list keeps growing. And this crime keeps growing. If you're to believe the admittedly unscientific data that our members report, the average romance scam loss is $18,146. It's also interesting to note that this loss has increased significantly over the past 2 years. It's up 49.5% from the $12,143 average loss reported in 2010. They come from every walk of life. Some are white collar, some are blue collar. We have lawyers, doctors, law enforcement professionals, and yes, even politicians. We have members who have PhDs, and we have members who've never graduated from high school. Some still work, some are retired, and some have been forced back into the workforce due to their losses. The two things they have in common are a working email address and an openness to a relationship. See, scammers are pros. They groom their victims, and over time, their methods have become more and more sophisticated. Through research, they take full advantage of every small loophole they can find. They use U.S. phone numbers to make them appear as U.S. citizens. They mask their IP address on their emails to make them appear local. And knowing that their victims fully trust them, they ask that funds be sent to the U.S. location that they're claiming to be from. They do this because they know that with a simple answer to a simple question, what's your favorite color, they can retrieve their stolen scam dollars without even showing identification. They can pick up the money anywhere in a foreign country where it's being sent or anywhere in a state designated where the money is supposed to be received. They can pick up the money anywhere in the foreign country where it's being sent or anywhere in the state designated where the money is to be received. The victim sending the money can't even tell law enforcement where the money went to, even though they paid that company to send it to a specific location. If the victim were to be told the money is being attempted to be picked up in Vancouver, where they thought they sent it to a loved one in Toronto, at least it would maybe give them pause to be able to figure out that they're being victimized. Asking a money transfer company to require the sender's permission to have a sender's dollar picked up somewhere other than where the sender sent the money seems to be only reasonable. It's a small, practical, common sense move to begin to address what can easily become a financially and emotionally devastating, catastrophic loss for the victim. Why would an industry fight such a common sense, ethical move unless it cared more about its profits than its customers? More about dollars than due diligence. It's time for our current laws and legislation to begin to catch up with cybercrime. The losses are huge, and they're growing. And this law is just one baby step towards protecting Minnesota constituents from a viral, growing, devastating criminal element that's invading our living rooms, our bedrooms, and our bank accounts, all through the computer screen. Please, pass this legislation.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Our next testifier is Michael Campion. Michael?
Madam Chair, members, Michael Campion is my name. I thank you for the opportunity. I work for MoneyGram International. I went to work for MoneyGram last November, so a year and a half or so. I, along with three or four other people around the country, do nothing but interact with the criminal justice system and law enforcement, prosecutors, defense lawyers across the country and Canada to try to provide them with the information and the data they need to investigate, prosecute, and to eliminate or prevent money laundering, terrorism financing, and any number of different fraud kind of activities. I'm here with all due respect to Representative Atkins. I followed the normal legislative protocol. I had a meeting with him and let him know that we would be having some words in opposition of his bill. Not that MoneyGram or anybody else is unsympathetic to vulnerable adults. I literally talk to law enforcement every day, 5, 6, 7 times a day, who represent some vulnerable adult who's been scammed. MoneyGram has made some remarkable accomplishments the last 3-4 years. To the best information that MoneyGram has, we had a fraud rate of about 3.1% in 2010. Last year, the reported crime was 0.04%, and that's on almost $700 million that leaves Minnesota every year. We're here in kind of tentative opposition to the bill for two reasons. One, we think it's unenforceable. We don't know how Minnesota law will have any effect in Jamaica or Mexico or any other foreign country, much less the other 49 states. I don't know how that's going to work. And I think legislators should be at least aware of the shortcomings of a piece of legislation and not be so euphoric to think that this piece of legislation is going to solve a very terrible problem that that vulnerable adults are continually to be disproportionately impacted. The second is we just do not think it's going to have an impact. Minneapolis has, I think, 100 MoneyGram stores. If you designate a location, Minneapolis, you're going to have any number of stores. I don't know if that's going to cut the problem down. Coon Rapids has 10. There's 631 in the state of Minnesota. I just do not think that, in my experience over the last year and a half, that this legislation is going to have any significant impact. What I do know has impact are some other things that have been done. We have developed, put millions of dollars into technology to identify suspected fraudulent transactions and prevent them from being sent prior to the transmissions being sent. We have a call center that's 24 hours a day. It was almost $1 million in fraud that was eliminated last year through the call center. It's a complicated deal, but people who send fraudulent transactions or have characteristics that seem to be fraudulent can't send that money to wherever they want to send it until they call or wire MoneyGram International and actually talk with an operator that talks them through. And like I said, almost $1 million was prevented from being sent last year. We have what's called a PFC list. It's a technical term for those people who continue to be vulnerable adults who simply will not listen, still think they're going to win the lottery, still think they're going to be recipients of a car or a romance scam. We can put them on a list and prevent them from ever sending money through MoneyGram again. I put one lady on yesterday, an 83-year-old woman, no family in Canada. I don't know how much money she sent, but she simply would not listen, and the Canadian authorities asked, and we put her on a list. I don't know what she can do with any other money transmitter, but she won't send any more money through MoneyGram. Education is, the real key. Vulnerable adults simply sometimes just will not believe that they are being scammed, even when you talk with them. I spent probably 15, 16 hours in our call center to listen to calls live where people called in and get mad. Say, what do you mean? What do you mean? That's my money. I can send it to Russia if I want to. I won the lottery in Jamaica. I can send that money if I want to. You can't prevent me. Talk them through it, and pretty soon you say, sorry, ma'am, MoneyGram will not facilitate this transaction. And they get mad, but they go back to the business. They collect their fee. They collect all their money. But that is kind of the problem that we're dealing with. And so a very strong education, I think, component, the ability to put people who continually be victimized, particularly vulnerable adults, put them on a list where they can't send any money, I think were some of the proven strategies that have reduced the amount of fraud that we have seen here in Minnesota. A comment was made earlier that it's a very unreported crime. All crimes unreported. This is the very accurate and latest information that we have statistically the last couple of years. I think some of the information that was referred to 3, 4, 5 years ago was accurate. Very well could have been. I don't know. I wasn't around here to make a judgment on that. But MoneyGram has made every serious attempt to try to minimize not only vulnerable adults, but the wide spectrum of people who get victimized by money transmitters. And again, I know this is a well-intentioned bill. I have a great deal of respect for Representative Atkinson. We just don't know that it's enforceable. I just don't know how it's going to have much of an impact at all.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for your testimony, and you are the last testifier, and we have room members for questions, so I'd like to go to the questions now. But I also just wanted to comment, because I have some constituents at home who are in their 70s who just sent this last year $4,500, the same grandchild type scam that Representative Atkins was talking about. And I just wondered, sir, you know, for you did say, and education is, we do need to educate those of us who could be scammed at any time. And I would just hope that you would work with us in finding some ways to help us avoid this, especially the elderly. I really think we're getting more and more of this. Very vulnerable elderly people are well-meaning people. We want to help our grandkids, and I think that's part of this. So I think this is a very good bill for us to, at a good place for us to discuss this. And I'm going to open it to questions to the other members as well.
Madam Chair, if I could just comment on that. Mm-hmm. You know, partnerships, I think, is what it's really all about, and be able to work together. There's a proposal out there somewhere that the Department of Commerce may come up with their own list of the victims that they've identified. Send that list to us, and we would incorporate it into our list. Makes complete sense to us. Complete sense. I think in your packet, if I'm not mistaken, there's a letter, an article written that we authored here at MoneyGram. I'm going to try to get it. In fact, I've got a commitment from the Chiefs and Sheriff's Associations to put it in their monthly or quarterly publications. Again, an attempt to get it out to law enforcement, what they need to do, what they can do. They don't need to be paralyzed by this thing. I get calls every day where law enforcement goes and investigates these cases. They don't all get solved, but if you have a person that's a focus of a lot of money going, you know, that local jurisdiction, they will do what they can to arrest that individual who is perpetrating these kinds of crimes. I think that there's a number of different outreaches and partnerships that MoneyGram, I'm not speaking for Western Union, but at least I know MoneyGram is very willing to do. That's what I do all day. If there's ways that we could partner with Department of Commerce or anybody else to get more information to seniors, that is an effective strategy. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. We do have questions. I believe Representative Hillstrom has.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Adkins, I am very strongly in support of your proposal. So I have a question for you. Are you telling me that this is not possible to notify the person who sent the money that the money is being picked up somewhere else?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I've never sent any money through a money service business. I bet you most people in this room haven't. So most people don't know how the process works. I go into a Walmart or a MoneyGram store, and I fill out a form. I want to send this amount of money to this person in this location. Here's my name, address, phone number. Fill out a form. It's just a template. It's got a million fraud warnings on it, by the way. And you send it to Representative Hillstrom in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. Now, you can pick it up in any one of the probably 5 or 10 MoneyGram stores in Brooklyn Center. And there is, when you get picked up, there is a record that is put into our system. It's available to us 24 hours later, generally speaking, unless it's on a weekend and volume is used on a holiday. And it has who picked it up, the name, address, phone number, the amount of money, time and date. And a lot of businesses, particularly Walmart, which is a very reputable company, have video surveillance of all of their transactions, send and receive. How would we notify, if you sent that to me, how would we notify you that which one of those stores or which one of the places in Minnesota that was picked up? I mean, that's, and how would you do it in another country? Like I said, 60% of the fraud in Minnesota goes to foreign countries. How are we going to, you know, there's diminished expectation that this bill is going to have any effect. You can't enforce something like that, and you think you're going to have any luck in Mexico or Jamaica, you know, much less the other 49 states.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, to follow up with that, then what makes you think we can prosecute it in those foreign countries or in the other states if we can't even get the notification?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, I think in foreign countries you're going to have a very difficult time unless you have a very understanding country. And I think Agent or Jim Ault went down to Jamaica. There was a cooperation there. Maybe they made some progress there some years ago, but you know, $1,000 from the United States in some foreign countries, I'm sorry, that's just not, it's just not a priority. We can we've had success, I think, collectively in the United States and in other cities, in other countries, I mean in other states, where there's been a number of activities and somebody's been identified, and we refer that to law enforcement all the time. Now, we don't always get everybody charged, we don't always get the money back, but to say that nothing is being done, I think is that's just not accurate. It might have been accurate 2, 3, 5 years ago, but it isn't accurate today.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you're just telling me that it's not possible to notify the person who sends the money that the money was picked up somewhere else, is what I think I heard, so correct me if I'm wrong. But then a follow-up question to that is, do you know anywhere else in the world, or anywhere else in our statute, or anywhere else in the world, that we punish the person who was a victim by telling them they can't ever use the service again? So a vulnerable adult is the victim of a crime, and we put them on a list and tell them you can't ever use this service again. Is there any other place in the statute that we do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, it's a very valid question. Frankly, it's a very valid question. Does the end of the day, is the good outweigh the evil? If you have a vulnerable mother that's gone through, like the earlier testimony, thousands and thousands of dollars, I'm way out on a limb here with some legal interpretation, but MoneyGram's a private company. I suspect maybe they have more latitude than other public companies to do, or a public state agency or a police department. Maybe they have more latitude because it's a private company. But we don't do it with people who go to a casino and dump all the kind of money that they want in the world. So, I mean, that's a valid question. But MoneyGram is doing it. We've prevented a huge amount of fraud, particularly when vulnerable adults simply will not believe that they're being scammed.
Just one final
question. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one just final question then. So once the fraud has happened, and once we can't prosecute it because the money goes to another country, does MoneyGram have any responsibility or any liability for the recovery of the money for the victim? And my final piece is, so it's a two-part question, is, so aren't you licensed in the state of Minnesota? And if you don't comply with this, wouldn't the state of Minnesota have the ability to not license you?
Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that, honestly.
Fair. Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to ask Representative Svigum. Sorry, I saw the sweater and I got thrown.
Would you like a hug?
Representative Atkins.
Come here.
Easy.
For those who don't know Representative Svigum, he was a hugger, at least among the.
Well, and in your defense, he would have way more color in that sweatshirt than you had in yours. Representative Sanders and Anzels and I were sitting over here wondering if we didn't do this last year or 2 years ago, and how is this different, or what are we fixing now that was different from the bill a couple of years ago?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, thank you for noticing. Not just the sweater, but we did try this a couple of years ago, and we altered it. In fact, if you look at House File 527, we provided some warnings, and we did some fraud prevention training for agents and monitoring agent activity. And the sense is, at least my strong anecdotal sense, and I think Chair Fritz's and others, is that wherever you go, you're still hearing these stories, and they're recent stories. And they're not just one or two or five, it's 10 or 20 of the same story over and over. And the one common denominator is people are still sending money to places where it's being picked up elsewhere, because that's what they do. And that's what's underlying this. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say I have a huge amount of respect for Mr. Campion. I am so glad that MoneyGram hired him. I have no doubt that MoneyGram is doing better than they've probably ever done before because of Mr. Campion's efforts there. So this isn't meant to undermine any of his efforts at all, but simply to supplement what's being done. And as Representative Hillstrom noted, simply a phone call to somebody who sent money saying your money's being picked up a state away might be able to shortcut it and prevent it from going through.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? I don't see any. Representative Atkins, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll renew my motion that House File 194 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
All in favor of that recommendation, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. The bill is on its way. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And to your next bill. Representative Atkins, to your next bill.
Madam Chair, for House File 527, I'd move passage of House File 527 recommended to pass and refer to the General Register.
And members, all in favor of that motion? First, I'm going to have you explain your bill.
Yeah, and it's very brief. And this shows the regard that I have for, I don't necessarily like what's happening to our seniors and others across Minnesota, but we made an effort in the past to work through this. We found one technical issue that arose, and that was there's folks that are trying to send a payment to their utility or something like that. That wasn't what we were targeting with our legislation last year or 2 years ago. And so MoneyGram actually approached me and asked if we could have a little bit of clarification. That is on line 1.9. That we're talking about transactions that are being sent to an individual. And that's simply clarifying. I don't believe that there's any testimony either in support or opposition to it, but simply a technical clarification. And I'd appreciate support.
And would anybody like to testify? Anybody in the audience want to step forward to testify, either be for or against this? Or any members, any questions? If not, Representative Atkins.
I'll renew my motion that House File 527 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
And members, now I will ask you, all in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And who's next? He was up there. You can see him good.
Yep. Representative Hillstrom, are you ready?
I am, Your Honor.
our tradition in this committee is always to hear from non-members of the committee who have bills before us. We're awaiting Representative Dabney. Representative Beard was also in the room. So as soon as they return, we will hear their bills once they return. But in the meantime, we have Representative Hillstrom has House File 266. And Representative Hillstrom will recommend House File 266 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Representative Hillstrom, to your bill, House File 266.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this came to me from the City of Brooklyn Center. Several years ago, the legislature adopted a bill that allowed brewers like Surly Brewing to apply for taproom licenses. However, the interpretation from the city attorney is that municipal liquor communities aren't eligible. This just says, yes, they are. I actually have spoken with Mr. Bagnoli, and they're fine, Mr. Chair. So he's here for questions. And I have nothing else, Mr. Chair.
Ladies and gentlemen, Representative Schoen, that's how you present a bill. If you're up next, that's aye. Are there any questions for Representative Hillstrom or Mr. Bagnoli? Seeing none, House File 266 is laid over for possible inclusion in the House Liquor Omnibus Bill. Next up, unless we have any non-Representative Beard. Thank you very much. We'll go to you next then.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Representative Beard's House File 168 for passage to the consent calendar. Or?
Give or take.
I'll move the bill, Mr. Chairman, committee or to the floor, whichever you desire.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. And Representative Beard, to your bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zellers, thank you. I appreciate the effort. Mr. Chairman, this is a simple little bill. Regarding our on-sale license for the city of Shakopee, actually permission for the city of Shakopee to work with our friends at Valley Fair to issue an additional on-sale license that includes mostly events. You have on your packet, in fact, I think it's being handed out right now, a letter of support from the city of Shakopee. They're in full accord with this. In fact, they actually made the request because of some things that Valley Fair is going to improve the park and improve their special events program. Members, the city because of legislation, because of the law here, can't just issue those. They actually have to come to you for your permission to do so, according to statute 348.404. Mr. Chairman, to explain a little more about it and stand for questions if you wish, I have my friend Dave Frazier, Vice President of Operations at Valley Fair Cedar Fair Amusement Park, here to explain a little more about it.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Mr. Frazier, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is David Frazier, representing Valley Fair. We're just looking for the opportunity to work with the City of Shakopee on our liquor license to provide us some more flexibility for requests that we get from our guests. Right now, we currently have 4 liquor licenses, so we do serve alcohol in the park. We're looking at, you know, just having the flexibility to work with them on different events that we had in the past where people have asked for weddings or different receptions with at a ride or a haunted house as we have a Halloween event. And that is basically what we're looking for.
Thank you, Mr. Frazier. Are there questions for Mr. Frazier or Representative Beard? Representative Anseltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Beard, just clarification. Mm-hmm. Is it accurate to say that you're going from 4 licenses to 1?
Representative Beard?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question because the licenses issued by the city now are specific to the restaurant locations. And what they're looking for is the authority to have work with Valley Fair to prescribe the parameters between the city, the police department, and Valley Fair to have liquor at different places at different times for special events and so on. I don't believe the other 4 will expire for the restaurant locations. I think this is going to be a specific application for those events. But, Mr. Chair, perhaps Mr. Frazier can correct me if I'm misreading.
Mr. Frazier, are we missing anything?
Mr. Chair, representatives, we're just looking for the opportunity to discuss, you know, what are the possibilities with the liquor license. Right now we have, you know, a lot of different venues. We have the water park. We have the sports bar. We have a pizza that serves beer. So it's just looking for the flexibility to discuss the options with them.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beard.
And if it would, I know that according to law, the cities are allowed to issue according, I think, to the population base, and staff can correct me if I'm wrong. So if it is possible that this becomes one license that can be negotiated, the City of Shakopee could conceivably have 4 more licenses that they can be available for other purposes. But if it pleases the committee, I can research that and get back to you with that information, and we'll find out what their intents are there.
Well, that's a good clarifying point. Perhaps Mr. McCormick, if you can check in with Representative Beard once he has a little bit more information. And any other questions from members at this point? All right, if not, thank you, Representative Beard. House File 168 is hereby laid over for potential inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill.
Yeah, thank you,
and
Mr.
thank
Chair
you,
committee.
Mr. Frazier, as well. Next up, we've got Representative Dabney in the room, and he's got a twofer. So we'll start with House File 182. The chair moves House File 182 be laid over for potential inclusion in the House Liquor Omnibus Bill. Representative Dabney, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Both House File 182 and House File 186 are recognitions that the beer industry has changed and become much more sophisticated and nuanced, and consumers are looking to do the same. House File 182 works off of work that this committee did in 2012 in establishing a wine educator license that allows individuals with proper certification to hold wine education events with protections in them. The attendees have to be pre-registered or purchase a ticket beforehand. You cannot sell off sale at the event if you're the licensee. You cannot even take orders for off sale at a later date if you're the licensee. The House File 182 then simply takes that statute and mirrors it, but allows it for beer educators. With me today is, I believe, the state's first Cicerone. This is vocabulary day in the Commerce Committee. A Cicerone is the beer equivalent of a sommelier.
Mr. Well, there you go.
There you go. You didn't know that before this, did you, Mr.
You know, Representative Dabney, there's a lot of stuff I didn't know, and most of it's not important, but this is. So Welcome to the committee. If you can just state your name and proceed with the testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, my name is Michael Agnew. I am Minnesota's first certified Cicerone and the owner of a business called A Perfect Pint, through which I do beer education events. The rapid rise of craft beer has brought with it new career opportunities in beer, one of which is beer educator. Similar to what wine sommeliers have been doing for decades, beer educators enlighten consumers on the finer points of their favorite beverage. Through private parties and corporate events, we expand beer drinkers' palates, introduce them to a broader range of flavors and styles, and explain where those flavors come from. We consult with food service industry to ensure the best handling and presentation of beer. And we train service staff how to better sell it. All of this helps promote the beer industry in general. So the reason for presenting this bill is that current Minnesota law creates obstacles for pursuing this. There is no legal avenue for a beer educator such as myself to purchase or provide beer for events. We have to go through complicated workarounds. We get led into odd legal gray areas. If I purchase beer for an event and charge that to my client, the state says that I'm reselling. There are times when even the client can't purchase the beer, which leads us into a question of, can we even legally do the event? So it puts beer educators in the position of having to either break the law or decline business. To give you some idea of the sort of weirdness that exists right now, last year the wine educators bill was passed, so there is a wine educator's license. I work frequently with a sommelier in town who is a licensed wine educator. We do events together, we teach classes together. For those same events in which each of us are doing exactly the same thing, she can purchase wine and charge that to her clients. I have to have the client go to a liquor store, pay for the beer, even though I can pick it up and then bring it to the event. So, you know, we run into these sort of oddball situations. So really all we're asking for is the ability to do the same thing that the wine educators currently can do because of this license.
Thank you, Mr. Agnew. Are there questions for Mr. Agnew or for Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
While I note that the MLBA is in the room, they have represented to me, as has the Department of Public Safety. Both entities are comfortable with this bill.
And I will ask, is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to House File 182? Seeing none, then thank you, Representative Dabney. Thank you, Mr. Agnew. House File 182 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Liquor Omnibus Bill. Representative Dabney, as long as you're there, the chair will move that House File 186 be recommended to, be laid over inclusion. I'm just used to the same pattern. But 186, Representative Dabney, to the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Currently, Minnesota state law allows nonprofit organizations to hold events where they sell tickets or accept a donation, and their supporters can have a glass of wine or two without having to pay a per-glass fee for that. The proceeds of that event then go to either that nonprofit's primary mission, charitable mission, or if they're doing it in cooperation with another nonprofit, to that nonprofit's primary mission. House File 186, again, mirroring for beer what we already do for wine, simply allows nonprofits to hold beer tasting events as they can now do wine tasting events. I do want to note to members, page 1, line 6, changes the title to alcoholic beverage tastings, but if you go into the bill, the only two forms of alcohol allowed are beer and wine.
Thank you, Representative Dabney.
With that, I seem to have Mr. Agnew again.
Mr. Agnew, as long as you're around, thoughts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This ties in actually very closely to the previous bill. As the popularity of beer has risen, I, as a beer educator, get asked by more and more by charitable organizations to lead beer tasting events as fundraisers. And once again, we get put into this position where it's unclear if or whether anybody is allowed to purchase beer for said event. This bill simply clarifies that. It makes explicit that beer can be purchased by charitable events or by charitable organizations for beer tasting specifically. It's really kind of I see it as a win-win for everybody. It, as I said, clarifies that, but it also gives them the explicit ability to purchase at wholesale beer for events, which they did not have before. But it also does not preclude wholesalers from donating beer should they want to donate to a charitable organization.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Agnew. Thank you, Representative Dabney. Is there anyone else who desires to be heard with respect to House File 186? Seeing none, anything else, Representative Dabney?
As with House File 182, both the MLBA and the Department of Public Safety have indicated their comfort with this bill as well, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to present both these bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. And with that, House File 186 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the House Liquor Omnibus Bill. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
Next up, Representative Franzen has joined us. She's got three bills, House File 940, 941, and 942. We'll move each one individually, Representative Franzen, but you and your testifiers are more than welcome to speak to any of the three, so long as we're kind of in an informal way laying bills over for possible inclusion. It's fine for you to speak about each of the three ideas. And with that, Representative Hoppe will move that House File 940 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Liquor Omnibus Bill. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'd like you to just close your eyes and envision the city of Osakis. City of Osakis has a population of 1,740, was founded in 1857, and it takes its name from the beautiful lake on which the town is located. The name Osakis is thought to mean place of the Sauk and commemorates a small group of Sauk Indians who lived near the lake in the early 19th century. Osakis is also known for the following things. The Sauk Valley Man was founded a few miles outside of Osakis in an important archaic period, an archaeological find that has been dated to approximately 2300 BC. Garwood, inventor of the hydraulic lift pump truck, a boat designer, boat racer, and world water speed record holder, was raised in Osakis and was a steamboat on the Lake Osakis that got him into racing. Peter Rutten was born in the Netherlands in 1880, founded the Osakis Silo Company in 1922. He designed and patented a new kind of silo roof in 1953, founded the Raylock Company in Plainfield, Illinois, to manufacture it. Tommy Gibbons and his brother Mike Gibbons, members of the International Boxing Hall of Fame, had a summer home on Lake Osakis. Tommy gave money from his last fight to build Osakis Church of the Immaculate Conception. I could go on and on, but now
we
have
that. I'm just kidding. Actually, what she knows is that this is also the tourism committee, and now we all want to go to Osakis.
Absolutely, so. And now Osakis is home to Panther Distillery. So, my new business in my district is the first legal whiskey distillery in Osakis. They get every ingredient is locally from the state of Minnesota, including the whiskey barrels they get from Albany. Mm-hmm. And so we are looking for some legislation on House File 940 that would allow Panther Distillery to be able to do some tastings, not to exceed 15 milliliters per variety per person. So I will let Mr. Adrian here discuss this bill.
Thank you very much. My name is Adrian Panther, and I am the owner of Panther Distillery, and we are the first legal whiskey distillery in Minnesota. I am a veteran, a husband, and a father of six children. And as the Congresswoman said, we are located, is that right? I hope I say that right. We're located in Osakis, Minnesota. We started building in 2010. We used all local lumber, cement, the land. All our contractors are from Minnesota locally. I have two operating 500-gallon stills. I have seven employees. And we use all local farmers for our products. Our corn, our wheat, our rye, our water are all Minnesota grown. What do we bring to our city, our county, and the state? We bring tourism and jobs. In the last 8 months, we have had over 7,000 visitors from all over the country come to Panther Distillery. The bills HF 940, 941, and 942 will allow me to double my staff and to build another building. I'm not asking for anything that the beer and wine producers already have. I do not want to be a bar, a liquor store, or a distributor of my own products. I just want to sample my products and sell a bottle. We are currently selling one product, Whitewater Whiskey. In Bill HF 940, sampling, I'd like to show you what 15 milliliters, looks like. And I, thank you.
Yeah. Is that whiskey?
No, no whiskey, I'm sorry.
Well, then you can keep them.
So if you look at this bottle, this is 15 milliliters. In this 15 milliliter sample, and a sample I would give a customer, only 6 milliliters of this is alcohol. No, well, we'd only, no mixed drinks. We're just going to give them a sample through a shot glass. The wine producers are allowed to sell 100 milliliters, which is 8 milliliters of alcohol, and then the beer distributors going to sell 433 milliliters of alcohol of beer, which is one pint, which has an alcohol content of 23 milliliters. I'm here to assure you that we do not want people to come to our distillery, sample our products, and then have them drive off intoxicated. That is not our goal. We just want to have a sample our product, which is this size, and then buy a bottle.
This bill doesn't address buying the bottle.
Right. I'm sorry. I'm just going to give you my thing I've written up. In closing, the bills will increase tourism and jobs. My goal is for the state of Minnesota, for when people come, people always talk about the best whiskey comes from Kentucky and Tennessee, and my goal is for people to come away and people in the country to say the best whiskey comes from Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Panther. Representative Franson, is there anyone else that you have to testify on House File 940? So I kind of expect that Mr. Panther will remain.
No? Yeah, no, not four, I don't believe. Does anybody? No? You are? Oh, you're testifying? Oh, okay.
Okay. Is that,
okay. I guess we're done.
Okay, then we will lay over House File 940 for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Representative Zellers will move House File 941 for potential inclusion in the House Liquor Omnibus Bill. Representative Franz in the House File 941.
Thank you. Members, this is a simple bill. Basically, Panther Distillery would also like to be able to sell one 750 milliliter bottle per customer at their site. So, for example, close your eyes, picture yourself walking into this wonderful new business in Osakis, sampling their wonderful white water whiskey, and then saying, wow, I would really like to purchase one bottle, and that's all they're asking.
Okay. Mr. Panther, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, right now, yes, just one bottle per customer. Currently, the wine producers are allowed to sell two cases, and all we want to do is sell one bottle.
Thank you, Mr. Panther. Are there questions or concerns from members of the committee? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Panther, for starting up a business in Osakis. I have been there. It's a great place. And, you know, I'm just kind of interested in this. Minnesota has a lot of companies throughout the Minnesota area. I know in Representative Faulk's district you have the Shaker's Vodka that's being distilled there, and wondering if they obviously would probably benefit from this. You might want to collaborate with them a little bit too on this, but I just wanted to make that comment.
Mr. Chair, I guess this is respond to that. Representative Anderson, I don't know if you bought the assets from Shakers, but I think they went belly up. So. I think that was actually owned by an investment firm out of California, and I don't know what happened entirely, but they're not doing so well.
And I'm sorry, we had a couple of folks on the list. Whether it was to the pass bill or this one is fine. Representative Swedzinski, you were on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question kind of is not necessarily connected to the bill itself, but just talking, you know, along the permitting process. How long did that process take for you to get your distiller's license within the state and that sort of thing?
Well, thank you very much. The federal license took about a year. The state license, the state of Minnesota has been the alcohol division has been first class. Getting my license, getting approval, having the fire inspection people come through has been first class. I mean, I have no complaints. If I have any questions, I can call them directly, and they answer all my questions. So, no, the state of Minnesota has been, you know, they're letting me plow the road every day, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Panther. And Representative Dean had a question as well.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is pretty simple. Is there a limit to the number of samples I can have when I show up to sample?
Mr. Pan?
Well, according to the bill, it's for one. You get one of these per product, from what the bill says. And right now, we only have one product. So this will. Is that answering your question?
Representative Dean.
Yeah, it is. Is there anything that this bill that would prohibit you from moving to 10 different products?
No, Panther. No, it wouldn't. But my goal right now, let me tell you, my goal is to make whiskey. And whiskey takes 2 years to sit in a charred white oak barrel. And that is my final goal. When I'm making whitewater whiskey, that helps me offset the cost for electricity, for employees, my grain bill, my corn bill, my water bill, to buy bottles, to pay my taxes, federal taxes, just for 1 gallon of whiskey before it even leaves before I even send it out, cost me $13.25 that I have to pay. So what this does, this allows me to put some money into my coffers, to hire more people, to pay the employees that I have currently. So, but yes, that's true. I mean, but that's not my goal. And we do have the ability, I think there is a law in Minnesota that says that we have the right and the ability to stop someone if we think they're inebriated. Currently on the books.
Thank you, Mr. Panther. Anything else or anyone else that desires to testify with respect to, we're now on House File 941, even though we've taken questions on all of these, but anyone else that wants to testify on 941? And we do have a couple citizens, I think, that want to testify collectively on all three. So we're going to hear from them after we take up the next bill. But we'll lay over
then. Actually, Mr. Chair, I'm going to withdraw House File 943, or no, 942. I'm going to withdraw that.
Thank you, Representative Franson. We will lay over then House File 941 for possible inclusion in the House Liquor Omnibus Bill. We do have Mr. Platzer and Mr. Smith who've requested to testify as well. Mr. Sir, if you'll just identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Robert McManus, and I'm the founder of the Mill City Distilling Company of St. Paul. I'm here to testify in support of these two bills that would modernize Minnesota laws relating to distilled spirit production and marketing. These three bills essentially are what wineries have enjoyed for years and what the Surly Bill did 2 years ago for small beer brewers. It is only fair that distilled spirits enjoy a similar opportunity. Minnesota is losing out on creating jobs, generating excise and sales tax revenue, supporting local agriculture, and developing a unique tourism business. In a time of sequestration and state budget gaps, distilleries such as Adrian's and mine will generate brand new tax revenue. There are two reasons to support this proposed legislation. The first is that other states that have enacted very similar laws have seen tremendous industry growth and benefits. States such as California, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Michigan, Missouri, Kansas, Ohio, New York, Georgia, Illinois, Iowa, and Wisconsin have created jobs, paid millions of dollars in taxes, developed entirely new sources of agricultural and customers, and generated tourism. The second reason deals with the paramount issue of public safety and alcohol. All of these aforementioned states, to my knowledge, to the best of my knowledge, have experienced no adverse impact from public safety on public safety from modernizing these laws. Passage of these bills would enable micro distilleries to buy the grain produced here and, in a Minnesota tradition, add value to these crops, in this case, fermenting and distilling. Distilleries create good jobs in rural locations and low-income areas. People are fascinated by whiskey making, and I know of distilleries around the country that host travelers far and wide to see how spirits are made. And finally, tax revenue. A liquor made in Minnesota means revenue and taxes stay in the state. Would passage of these sampling and retail laws pose a threat to the three-tier system? Absolutely not. The three-tier system was enacted in 1933 to protect the public from large, powerful brewers. Updating laws for current times and consumer demand would allow distillers to make and market spirits from local grain and orchard products for consumers. I am currently renovating and fitting out my distillery in the vacant Hams Brewery on Minnehaha Avenue in St. Paul. These laws would enable small distillers to take local crops, local manufacturing, local labor, and produce and sell great products to consumers and bring local pride back to the Hams Brewery. Finally, these laws will make a difference. The 45th Parallel Distillery in New Richmond, Wisconsin, is only 39 miles from here. This distillery was founded by Paul Wernie and Scott Davis of Minneapolis. Now, why would two Minnesotans go start a distillery in Wisconsin? I'll tell you, 6 years ago, the laws of the state drove them over the bridge, that's why. And finally, just to make this testimony a bit tangible, I'll put up a bottle of this vodka that they make over at 45th Parallel from corn. This is a product that's from Wisconsin that, by all rights, should be from Minnesota. I know it's close to 5 o'clock, so you guys hold yourselves back from this.
Looks partially consumed already, Mr. McMahon.
No.
And
that I'll take any questions.
Are there questions for Mr. McManus? And other than can we have the bot? No. Thank you very much, and appreciate your comments, and Mr. Panther and Representative Franz, and appreciate you bringing the bills. We've got two bills left before us this evening. Representative Johnson, are you ready to go on House File 1038? Is regarding the Lower Town Regional Ballpark on sale liquor license. And we've got, so Representative Johnson will move that House File 1038 be laid over for possible inclusion of liquor omnibus bill. There is an A1 amendment, Representative Johnson.
Yes. Mr. Smith and I were here to testify on 949.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Smith.
I will be brief.
No, feel free.
Okay, sorry. Excuse me, the page said he hand out the...
You bet. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. If you just state your name and then proceed with your testimony.
Nicholas Smith. I am a university researcher as well as an industry consultant in the wine and grape industry here in Minnesota. I believe most of the economic benefits of microdistillation has been discussed in detail. So as far as non-grain production, I'd like to say that the opportunity for microdistilleries to enhance their businesses and make them more profitable would also help small fruit producers in the apple and grape industry by providing a value-added product for their produce for small farmers in Minnesota that may not be fit for apple consumption, whether they're blemished or otherwise, or we're making quality wine in case, you know, we get a bad year and chemistry is off.
Thank you. That's helpful. Appreciate your testimony. Yes, sir. Could you state your name and proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ross Pletzer, P-L-A-E-T-Z-E-R. And just a someone who's been coming here since 2009, pushing for micro distillery licenses and improvements. We worked with Senator Hamilton, Nick and I did, Representative Hamilton, 2 years ago to drop the fee from $30,000 to the current $1,150. Since that time, Mr. Panther's opened his distillery. There's a planned distillery in Northfield called Loon Liquor, and there's another planned distillery, as we heard, which is the Mill City facility. Generally in the country, in the year 2000, there were 24 micro distilleries. Now there's 250. What's happening in the micro distillery is what has already happened in the craft beer industry. But if you look at our sister states, Wisconsin has 9 micro distilleries. Michigan has 11. Traditionally, conservative southern states, such as South Carolina, has 7, and Georgia has 5, with 3 more planned. So what is the difference between why we have 1 and 2 more on the way, and these have many more than we do? All of those states allow samplings, and they are limited off-sale of the manufactured product. We pushed for this 2 years ago. There was a lot of reception, but it didn't get in the omnibus bill. We're asking that you put it in this time. I passed out a handout that tries to accomplish that. The problem with the three-tier system with the micro distilleries is that unless a wholesaler takes your product, you can't get into liquor stores. Mr. McCormick put a paper out on the three-tier system back in 2008, identified 147 alcohol distributors. Only 7 of those are liquor distributors, and most of them won't give you the time of day unless you've got a product that people want. People can't want the product unless they've tasted the product, so they have to be able to sample it and buy a bottle to take home and share with their friends. The problem that Mr. Panther's bill has, as was pointed out by a couple of people here, is that it needs to be cleaned up a little bit, and this was the language we pushed for back in 2009 and 2011 in our handout. I think in 940, I think we've got to say that it can be given without charge, and in a total amount not to exceed 45 milliliters a day per person, which is what most states have. The fact that Mr. Panther's only producing white whiskey now, the bill's not just for him, it's for everybody. Eventually he's going to produce a bourbon, and he might make a gin someday, and he's going to want to have people sample all of them. I really think there needs to be a limit on the amount you give people. You don't want people going out with 4 or 5 samples. 15 milliliters is close to half a shot. Second, I think that when you start producing other things, let's say you make a bourbon, a rum, and a gin, you should be able to sell a bottle of each to people. South Carolina, very conservative state, lets you buy 3 750 milliliter bottles of different products in a given day to a given person. And I think that we need something like that here. We can't just have a one bottle rule. We've got to let people buy other products that are made so they can get word of mouth around and get them in the liquor stores. The liquor store that I use in Southwest Minneapolis, France 44, said it's very difficult to sell someone who's paid $22 for a bottle of Jack Daniels to pay $45 or $50 for a bottle of craft bourbon, but once you let them sample it, it's not a problem. So to grow the industry, we need to have sampling with some limits, and we also need to have the ability to buy a couple of bottles. It's not the destruction of the three-tier system. In fact, the more micro distilleries that succeed, the more they will seek out the three-tier system, because self-distribution takes too much time and effort. So we would be grateful if you would review these again as they were reviewed back in 2011. For the most part, micro distilleries aren't rich men and women. They need help, and these two bills, 940, 941, we respectfully suggest will help the industry. And I hope, I mean, I don't know, the three-tier gentleman was at the Senate hearing. I don't know if he's going to talk today, but it's not the end of the three-tier system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pletzer, and thank you, Mr. Smith. We appreciate your comments. My understanding, we have one more testifier, Mr. Jorgis, who's also interested in either 940 or 941, and then we're going to go to Mr. Bagnoli and Representative Johnson's bill. Mr. Jorgicus and Mr. Bagnoli, welcome aboard.
Mr. Chairman, you have a Greek and an Italian in front of you, so You don't know what to expect, perhaps. But my name is Chris Jorgikas. I'm a lobbyist for Wirtz Beverage Minnesota. I am here to speak on both House File 940 and 941 and to raise some serious concerns that both Wirtz Beverage, but I believe others in the wholesale and retail industries have about these two bills. I want to leave you with two thoughts, Mr. Chairman and members. One is, and this was previewed by the previous testifier, there are concerns about the three-tier system and the erosion that has occurred over the last 15 years with small exceptions that have been made to it. The three-tier system was created after Prohibition 80 years ago this year by the Minnesota legislature and by legislatures around the country to eliminate the sort of problems that exist in the liquor industry prior to the enactment of Prohibition, which essentially relate to controlled tied houses, vertical integration, in which manufacturers had direct financial and operational control of retail outlets, leading to substantial overconsumption and to corruption within the marketplace. And that's the essential reason for the three-tier system. It's been suggested that the effect of Representative Franzen's bills would be to simply permit distilled spirits to be treated the same as wine from farm wineries and also craft beers. But the fact of the matter is we're dealing with a commodity that has an alcohol by volume of approximately 35% to 60%. Most whiskeys and other hard liquors have 40% alcohol by volume, 80 proof, substantially greater than you find in beer or wine. Now, Mr. Panther distributed an exhibit of what 15 milliliters entails. But you'll see that the language of House File 940 provides for 15 milliliters per variety per customer. If you look at Panther Distillery's website, you'll see that they have several offerings either currently in production or available within 1 year. Under the current language of House File 940, it would permit 2.5 fluid ounces to be distributed to each customer who wanted to have a sample of all five of those varieties. In effect, Mr. Chairman, I think the technical term is two stiff drinks. And we have to be concerned, as I think the previous testifier indicated, about the amount of hard liquor that would be dispensed under this bill by a distillery who has several varieties. The second thing I want to share, Mr. Chairman, is just this. The suggestion that distilled spirits ought to be treated the same as wine and beer has to be reconciled with the fact that in many respects we discriminate between distilled spirits on the one side and beer and wine on the other in several laws that relate to beverage alcohol. We apply a different excise tax to distilled spirits than we do to wine and beer. We have different regulatory different laws that regulate distilled spirits, including the primary source and the open wholesaling laws. So I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that it certainly has been the policy of the state in the past to recognize that distilled spirits is substantially different than beer and wine and ought to be treated accordingly. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jorgikas. Mr. Pignoli.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be brief. It was an interesting testimony, and I've been to Mr. Panther's distillery, and it's really a terrific distillery. He's done a wonderful job in creating it. He began his testimony by saying, "I don't want to be a liquor store," and then proceeded to say, "Except for I want to sell one bottle per customer." Then by the end of the hearing, we had the last gentleman saying, "We need to sell two or three bottles to customers." The Osakis Municipal Liquor Store is within a quarter mile. It's almost within the site of the distillery. They sell Panther. They sell the product in that store. My concern is, and I want him to be successful, just as distilleries around the nation have been successful and breweries in the state of Minnesota have been successful. But I don't know if you need to be able to sell it on site, especially when I know I live in St. Paul. I know in my liquor store I went and asked, they have Panther.
I'm sure in the liquor stores in St. Paul that the gentleman who plans to open a distillery in Minnesota, they will carry his product, provided it's a good product. So I would just suggest that the sale of one bottle of whiskey, and to analogize it to farm wineries where they are allowed to sell wine, nobody is going to use a farm winery as their liquor store. You have to, a farm winery has to be on farmland. It can't be located in Grand Avenue or on the east side of Minnehaha Avenue. It has to be located on farmland in order to do it. One bottle of whiskey is different than one bottle of wine. One bottle of whiskey can either sit for a long time, and people can begin to use it as their liquor store. So that would be our concern with that thing. I will reiterate, though, Mr. Panther is doing a wonderful job, and I wish him all the success in the world. With that one provision, though, I think we have some difficulty.
Thank you, Mr. Mignoli. Thank you, Ms. Bjorkis. That concludes our testimony with respect to House Files 940 and 941. Representative Johnson, your bill's actually already been moved because you were walking up there. You moved House File 1038 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. You have an A1 amendment, and I assume you're moving the A1 amendment, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, we don't need that amendment because it's already incorporated in the bill, so we can just forget about that.
Very good. Representative Johnson, then to your bill.
And what this bill does, members, is, Mr. Chair, is provide for an on-sale license at the Lower Town Regional Ballpark where the Saints will be located, and that's kind of the long and short of it.
Particularly the short of it. Are there any questions for Representative Johnson? Is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to House File 1038? House File 1038, pursuant to Representative Johnson's motion, is therefore laid over for potential inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Schoen, you want to take a lesson from how Representative Johnson presents the bill?
I'm going to get this to go.
Representative Schoen will move that House File 839 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Representative Schoen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one quick fix, if I could, make a oral amendment on line 2.11 after intoxicating liquor at, in delete A, insert locate in at locations, at least, or at locations.
Got it. With that incorporated change, then, Representative Schoen,
yes,
to your
yes,
bill.
Sir. Mr. Chair, members, you know, I have to acknowledge the great women and men who already forged this this water on this type of bill. Basically, this bill is extending the same provision allowed for the TCF Bank football stadium beer sales to the general seating, now to also do that at Mariucci and Williams Arena. It is that simple. And with that fix I did in that amendment, it also amends the bill where there was a bit of a technical glitch where at TCF Bank they're selling beer in more than one location, and the beer, the way the bill read previously, they would technically be in violation, according to staff, by selling more than one location. That's it.
Thank you, Representative Schoen. We have one testifier who signed up, Mr. Iverson from the University of Minnesota, to present the university's point of view, and then we have some question or two for members. Mr. Iverson, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to be honest, when I took a job with the university, I never thought I'd be spending so much time in front of the Commerce Committee talking about liquor.
You love it, though, don't you?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Good answer.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Todd Iverson. I represent the University of Minnesota. I want to thank the author and the committee for allowing me to testify this evening. As the committee knows, last year we came to an agreement around this issue, and there's a sunset provision that occurs on this provision at the end of next year. We are very interested in seeing how that experiment plays out. I have to tell you that this year was a very successful year at TCF Bank Stadium. I do want to clarify some news reports that have been erroneous about the amount of money that the university realized from the sale of beer at TCF Bank Stadium. Net profit to the university itself was approximately $16,000. The gross sales was around $990,000. We are happy that our fans had a pleasurable experience and enjoyed the opportunity But I just wanted to make that clear about the amount of money that came into the university on the sale of beer at the stadium. Mr. Chairman, and I haven't had a chance to have a sit-down meeting with the author yet, but I look forward to that, and I told him we were trying to schedule an appointment with him. We do have a couple of concerns, and this isn't saying that we're opposed to the bill, but we have concerns about it being implemented this year. Couple of things. There are significantly more games at Mariucci and at Williams. There are the predominance of those are in the evenings, and we are in a neighborhood in the center of Minneapolis, and so we would like to think through that and talk with the author about that. We also, it's a very different fan experience at the two these two venues than it is at the football arena or at the football stadium. The arena, you're very close to the participants. There is beer sold at North Dakota, and they've had some issues around that that we want to talk about and try to figure out how to do. We're dealing with the issues around football and have had a very successful experience and a good fan experience for our patrons. And before we implemented anything else, we want to kind of get through that process. So I guess, Mr. Chairman, from the university's perspective, what we're asking for is that we do the two-year experiment on the football stadium. We'll come back. We have to come back to you and talk about this. And we're not saying absolutely not, but we just want a little time to think about this and also talk to our neighbors, quite frankly, about what it would mean to their community, and also talk to the owners of the establishments that sell beer around us. I know that we have some very successful bars and restaurants that have a keen interest in this. We've heard from a couple of them already. So that's the university's perspective, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate yours and the committee's time. And any questions, I would be happy to answer.
And thank you, Mr. Iverson. Representative Schoen, would you be open to an amendment that would prohibit sales in North Dakota of beer?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, just
Representative Schoen.
I had just a comment on that, and maybe there was questions flying around that maybe I'll cover. But, you know, we talked about that under $20,000 mark, but the reality is that that's almost $1 million worth of beer. And that beer had to be manufactured, that beer had to be delivered, that beer had to be sold at the stadium. Those are all jobs. The tax revenue to the state of Minnesota, according to staff, asked Mr. Michael in tax committee, I said, so if you're putting all this together, what is that revenue to the state of Minnesota in taxes? And so evidently, by the calculation, which I'm still learning, that's about $80,000 in revenue to the state of Minnesota. Am I going to fix the budget hole with this for anybody? Absolutely not. But it's still jobs. It's still a tax revenue. The state of Minnesota, the U of M, has a great police department. It's one of the finest educational institutions in the country. And there's a lot of smart people over there. I think they could put together a good plan to put these things in place safely, which they did for the football game. I know they were uncomfortable with it with football. But one thing that we are missing is the sales of premium seating and
the renewal of the suites?
The suites, thank you. I mean, I think if people aren't excited to go buy the suites, that's a revenue loss there too. So I appreciate the opportunity to sit down and visit with the U and would be glad to talk about timing and make sure that everybody's comfortable with it. But, you know, Beer for All worked pretty well at the bank. I think Beer for All can work pretty well at the rest of the stadiums too. And this is expanding that. We want the sports programs to do very well. And anything that I can do to help make the U look better and in sports and recruiting and whatever, I know that they're probably under a little microscope here at the legislature this year for various issues, but we're gonna help them do better.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Schoen. We got a question or two, and then we're going to lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question might not be a great question, but why are we excluding the new Siebert Field from this?
I'm sorry, what?
The baseball field, the new baseball field.
They're so good you don't need a beer to watch them. Representative Schoen?
So that, Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, that was brought up. I right now we just went with wherever they're selling beverages, and my understanding from research staff is that's not one place that they actually intend to sell beverages at all. And if they do, I guarantee you we'll be back.
Any other questions for Representative Schoen or Mr. Iverson? Representative Zeller's defending beer sales in
North Carolina. No, I wasn't, but I mean, if you want to, you know, balance a budget, I'm telling you, on behalf of Mr. Georgicus and I's relatives and friends, you're missing out on a serious revenue source. But go ahead, exclude them. Representative Schoen, the thing that I and thanks, Representative Lilly, and we went down this road a few years ago. You know, we it wasn't exactly easy at that time, so the appreciation for the road plowed. Representative Lilly did a lot of work on this, and it is a good thing going forward. And Mr. Iverson as well, I just wanted to publicly thank you and the university for coming to a conclusion on the record, because I know it wasn't something that we were excited about at the beginning, and it was maybe forced on you, and I think this is a better fit for everyone. So I just wanted to thank you and the university on the record for coming to a very positive conclusion, and Representative Schoen wants to plow new ground, I'll be happy to help him.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Unless there are any other comments or questions, I would...
Mr. Chair, just one other thing, and we maybe don't have to do this right this second, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for pointing this out, because we noticed this before. Related to halftime, obviously hockey's three periods on line 2.14, and just to somehow fix that, I would even look for some suggestion of what the best time may be, whether it's you know, to add the second period of hockey, or
Mr. Chair,
Representative Zellers,
and Mr. Pender, I don't know if we've done this in the past, but we were looking at this before. Wasn't it a percentage of the event that had been played? So whether it was 50% of the event or 2/3 of the event or something along those lines.
Hey, Mr. McCormick.
Or Mr. McCormick. I look at McCormick and said Pender. My
Mr. Chair, he's the smarter one of the two of us.
Honestly, I don't have the bottle over here. I promise I don't.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers. We usually try to pick some portion of the game, but I think it's important that it be a clean, measurable moment. And when the horn goes off for halftime in a football game, that's measurable. And so I'd recommend at the end of the second period.
Is the author comfortable incorporating that language?
Yes, sir.
All right, that'll be incorporated. One nice thing about laying bills over for possible inclusion is that we got a little bit more time to noodle on them and cogitate and so forth. But, by the way, I would share Representative Zeller's comment. Mr. Iverson, thank you to the university for the way that you've carried that out. My understanding is that alcohol-related incidents at games are down something like 40-some percent as well. So the manner in which you took to task what happened in the legislature is commendable, and thank you. And Representative Schoen, with that,
thank you.
We'll lay over House File 839 for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Folks, that concludes our agenda. We stand adjourned. Tomorrow might go a little bit late because we've got at least a couple of bills that may take a little while longer, so just for your planning purposes, keep that in mind. With that, we stand adjourned.